Hey, I'm just letting you know that in February 2023, I am speaking at my friend Andy Storch's event in Sonoma, California. It's called the Talent Development Think Tank. I'll be running a session on marketing your workshops. And on day three, I'll be hosting the 2-hour workshop blueprint session. I'd love to see you there. Head on over to leannehughes.com/thinktank. Enjoy the episode. Coming up next on Leanne Hughes's Work and Live Large.
And what they do is they found that the strongest correlation with the words creativity and change was actually things such as pain and vomit. because even though people say they want change, the reality is we're wired for survival. So what ends up happening is we know we need, at a conscious level, we know we need innovation. We know we need to be doing things differently. But it ruins our chances of survival in many respects, because what we've done in the past kept us alive. Therefore, doing something differently feels risky.
Life's too short, so you're here to work and live large. Here's your host with nothing to lose, Leanne Hughes.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm your host, Leanne Hughes, and I'm here to help you imagine what's possible is possible for you. Today's guest, I heard him first chat to Jenny Blake on her podcast, on her Pivot podcast, back mid-pandemic. I think it was May of 2020. And he really helped me figure out what to do next with my business when face-to-face delivery had sort of fallen by the wayside, because he talks about innovation as staying relevant. And so I feel like with all the constant changes in our world, it's so important to consider how can you and your business remain relevant. And that is through the process of innovation. His name is Stephen Shapiro. In this conversation, we discuss what is it that makes your business distinct? What is it that you offer? And how is that durable so that it will stand the test of time and so that others can't copy it? Such an awesome question. I also read his latest book, Invisible Solutions. This is his sixth book. And I asked him questions related to stuff in that was just so surprising and shocking for me. But in the book and through this discussion, you'll hear how it makes sense. I mean, for example, the word creativity. We think it's a positive word and everyone says they want to be creative. Yet what Stephen will share in this conversation is actually what goes on underneath the surface in terms of our subconscious and what we actually really think about creativity. We also talk about how far do you consult? And I think a lot of leaders in businesses, they know it's important to consult, but how far do you go when it comes to innovation and getting solutions? And of course, focusing on great questions, thinking about those as opposed to rushing to solutions. Stephen Shapiro cultivates innovation by showing leaders and their teams how to approach, tackle, and solve their business challenges. The first innovation opportunity Stephen spotted was the opportunity to innovate within his own life and with his team at Accenture. He left Accenture in 2001. I left Accenture after only about just over a year in 2008. But he left after publishing his first book, 24/7 Innovation, to become a full-time innovation speaker and advisor to clients around the world. Today, Stephen continues to work with transforming businesses like 3M, Procter & Gamble, Marriott, Nike, and Microsoft to improve innovation practices through customized keynote speeches, advisory engagements, and other services. Stephen has a degree from Cornell University in industrial engineering and is based out of Orlando, Florida. And of course, all the links to contact Stephen and find out his details will be in the show notes for this episode. You can find him at stephenshapiro.com, show notes at podcast.leannehughes.com. Reach out to Stephen, let him know what you thought of this one. Enjoy the episode. I'm excited to welcome onto the podcast, Stephen Shapiro. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure, Leanne. Glad to be here.
Hey, in your book, Invisible Solutions, in chapter one, it says, better questions lead to better answers. So that puts a lot of pressure on the interviewer, aka me today, to ask you some good questions. I just want to kick off by asking a bit about your background and maybe a pivot or a watershed moment that happened in your career that led you to do the work that you do today.
Well, back in the early 90s, so dating myself a little bit, I was at Accenture. Back then it was Anderson Consulting. And the work that I was focused on was what was called business process reengineering. It was all around optimizing processes. So how do we make companies more efficient? And one of the things that I figured out, because it slapped me in the face, was that when companies would optimize their processes, they would downsize their workforce. They would use it as an excuse to let people go. And then there was one day when I just woke up and I saw the impact of the downsizing on people's lives. And I just thought, you know, I can't do this anymore. This is not what I want to do with my life. So I actually walked off a project. Took a leave of absence, spent 6 months sort of studying my navel, trying to figure out what's going to be next in my life. And I liked working for the company. I liked the work I was doing. So I decided, well, I want to do what I'm doing, but instead of helping companies shrink, I want to help them grow. Back in the mid 90s, innovation wasn't really much of a word, but I decided to focus on innovation. We grew that to 20,000 people. And that's what I've been doing ever since for the past 25 years is only focused on innovation.
I love how you just sort of casually say we grew up to 20,000 people. I'm sure there's like a whole podcast just within that as well. And by the way, I my first job out of university was with Accenture, but I only lasted a year. It is a great company. You talk about optimizing process. And when I hear that, I think, things have to change around here. And I'm curious, like when you are working with people and you ask them questions about why process exists and they answer with things like, oh, it's always been done this way. That's just the way we do it around here. How do you typically respond to that?
Well, a lot of it comes down to what's the purpose of an organization? What's the purpose of a specific organization? And in a lot of cases, what ends up happening is they're doing things, like you said, they do things because they always did it. But I think the bigger question is, why does the organization exist? And if we can reverse engineer their existence into a new business model, that gives us a lot more power. So instead of perpetuating the past, instead of doing everything that we've always done previously, how can we figure out what we need to be for the future? What is it that our customers want, need, and desire that we can provide better than anyone else, that no one else can provide? And that's going to stand the test of time. And if we can focus our energies there, now everything else sort of follows suit behind that. So that's, to me, the key is don't do what you've done in the past, because past success is not a great predictor of future success. It's actually a great predictor of future failure.
Oh, that's a great quote. I don't know if you've tweeted that. We'll have to, that's a definite sound clip. When you do work with business and you ask them about their mission, I often find that they don't know how to answer it. And sometimes a mission is about providing value to shareholders, which isn't very aspirational. Which I find is really interesting. I mean, even if you would ask me right now, what is my business mission? I don't know if I could easily answer that. Do you find that when you work with executives and teams?
Yeah, my work really isn't around mission, vision, purpose, and things of that nature. I figure that's something which there are other people who really focus on that. I look at my work as more the bridge between that and success. So one of the things which I focus on, one of my pieces of work is around the topic of differentiation. Now, differentiation can help inform your mission and vision. And basically, differentiation to me doesn't mean how are you different, but rather, what is it that you do better than anyone else in the world? What is it that makes you distinctive? What is it that you offer that's desirable, both externally and internally? And how is it durable so that it will stand the test of time and others can't copy it and that it won't be disrupted at some point in the future? And so when we look at it through that lens, you get a different perspective than a mission vision statement, because those tend to be very vanilla. They tend to be almost interchangeable across most companies. And I'm not saying we don't need them or want them, but the key is to make sure we have clarity around something which is going to help drive the ship and move us forward in a way that is going to help us determine what do we do, but equally important, what aren't we going to do? What are we going to stop doing? Because the only way to really be successful is to know what to stop doing, as well as to focus on what we need to do in order to be the best that we can be.
Yeah, I really like that question around what to stop. I've got a list here. It's things that I've got to stop doing. It's called my not to do list, which is to grow and to do things differently, you need to absolutely stop things. Just on the topic of differentiator, a quote here in your book, only innovate where you can differentiate. That really struck me. And what I find interesting is that I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago, I actually had a virtual assistant overseas and I got them to research the ASX, the Australian top listed companies in Australia, top 500, and find out what their company values were. And innovation was, in about a quarter of those company values. And so when I think about, and I've worked in many companies where innovation has been a value, and they innovate on the core service, but not in the way that they actually, run everything else. So I'm curious, what are your thoughts on companies that have innovation as a value, and should it be lived across the way they recruit, the way they work, or their core service? Or are you sticking to your guns with it should just be for the area that they can differentiate in?
Well, I think every company has to have innovation as something they value. I mean, maybe it's not one of their core values, but if they don't value innovation, they're not going to be around for very long. And I think the problem, though, is you look at the posters of the companies that list, you know, innovation as one of their values, and it's like, we think differently, or we care about our customers. And they're just so bland. There's not like any company could say the same thing. So it really does come back to, what does innovation mean for you and your organization? Like, what is it really going to look like? Now, at the highest level, I always think of innovation as not creativity. It's not a lot of the things that people think. To me, the key to innovation is relevance. That's why we innovate. We innovate in order to offer the market something that they want, need, desire, will open up their wallets and do business with us. And we're the only ones that they will want to do business with for this particular capability. So what we need to do is take that concept of innovation and drive it down to differentiation, because unless you can articulate your differentiator, basically every company has the same direction. And that can't be. You can't have three companies in the same industry doing exactly the same work and expect all of them to be equally successful. It doesn't mean that you can't be in a space and do something in a different way and create different value, which means maybe you'll exclude some customers, but then there'll be others who are really attracted to what you do.
Yeah, it is quite, I like that you put the tag on it about maintaining relevance. And what I found, I mean, the companies that have survived the last couple of years have, you can tell that maybe if innovation isn't one of their core values, they're continuously looking for new services to offer and how to meet the market as well. You touched on, you used the word creativity there. And there was something in the book that I had no idea that this was a thing. You shared a study in the UK which associated the word creativity with negative connotations. Can you share more about that with listeners?
Sure. Actually, the study, this particular one was out of Cornell University. And what they did is, so there's a test called the implicit association test, which is a way of being able to test our implicit biases, our subconscious beliefs, rather than what we believe and say consciously, explicitly. And so what they do is they pair words together, and they're doing a whole bunch of measurements. It's really, really fascinating work. Google it, implicit association test. And what they do is they found that the strongest correlation with the words creativity and change was actually things such as pain and vomit. To me, it was just because even though people say they want change, the reality is we're wired for survival. So what ends up happening is we know we need, at a conscious level, we know we need innovation. We know we need to be doing things differently, but it ruins our chances of survival in many respects, because what we've done in the past kept us alive. Therefore, doing something differently feels risky. So there's this disconnect between what we say and what we deeply think in an ingrained level. And that is one of the challenges with innovation, is how do you get people to overcome that bias towards what they've done in the past?
Yeah. It was a real eye opener for me, because I think I've branded myself as everything about let's have change is great. And then I think, gosh, what is the association with that? And those words are quite strong. And you even said in your book as well that you don't even use the word innovation around executives. You don't use it.
Depending on the situation. So
okay. Yep.
There are some companies where there are really strong antibodies against the word innovation. Like if you go in there, and the problem comes down to definition. Again, for most people, they think of innovation as separate from the business. It's a group of people who do something totally different and has nothing to do with the daily business. But that's not what innovation is. Innovation actually should be ingrained, embedded deeply in the entire organization. Everybody needs to be contributing to innovation in some way. And so if there's a company, though, that says, innovation, that's not our thing. We don't want to be doing that. I take a different approach. And the approach, and this works really well, especially when starting off, is to say, okay, well, you have problems and opportunities, right? So if you talk to any executive, leader, you know, somebody who has a budget, whether it's a P&L leader or a line of business leader or a division or business unit leader, and you go to them and you say, we're not going to talk innovation today, but I know you've got three problems, issues, opportunities, challenges that keep you up at night. What are those? And they will articulate what that opportunity is. that then becomes the basis of the conversation. Now, the reality is innovation is not about ideas. It actually is about solving problems. It's about being able to tap into opportunities. So really all we're doing is changing the language so that we can make it more accessible to people and meet them where they are rather than creating something which feels foreign to them.
Mm. You mentioned, so innovation is not about ideas. There does, I mean, everything you're saying is like these strong associations with like, ideas, creativity, design sprints. What do you think about the one day design sprint?
I think those are great as long as, and I think the key with all of this is we get so focused on quantity of ideas and we get so focused on everybody's opinions and suggestions that we lose sight of what matters. So it comes back to the beginning of our conversation. An organization has to be designed around, reverse engineered around, what is its purpose? And when I use purpose, it could be how you differentiate. So not all opportunities are going to be equal. Therefore, if you're going to do these design sprints, if you're going to do hackathons, whatever it might be, don't just try to solve any old problem. Try to solve the problems that are differentiated problems. Try to identify the ones that if you could solve it would actually give you an extremely large return. And if you can focus there, that's going to give you the greatest impact. So it's not about quantitative ideas. It's not about getting lots of people engaged. That's part of the process. But it really is trying to figure out if we have a limited amount of resources, where do we focus our energy to get the greatest bang for our buck so that we're really going to have a great return. And let's face it, at the end of the day, certainly publicly traded companies, whether we like it or not, shareholders really are an important stakeholder. And so we need to satisfy what they do. And the only way to do that is to make sure we're efficient and effective in the way we deliver change.
Yeah. It's rather than that sort of scattergun approach, it's what is this focused towards? Is it an aid of the purpose? And that was exactly another thing. I think, you know, we are in a situation with society now. It's all about, you know, inclusion, hearing from all voices. And again, you shared this, something that happened in the UK when they put out a vote to name a boat, which is like this example was classic. I mean, I'm sorry to getting you on here to share these stories, but they're awesome. And like, again, it's a good, I mean, yeah, I'd love you to share the story and then maybe what the lesson is in for that in terms of stop casting the net out wide and asking for everyone's opinion.
Yeah. So this one was out of the UK just a handful of years ago. And they had this, I think it's like a 300 million pound Arctic Explorer that they built. And they decided to ask the citizens of the UK to name it. And so people could submit their names that they liked, and they could also vote on the other names that people submitted. And, you know, it's what's fascinating is the winning name was Bodie McBoatface with 123,000 votes. Number two had like 30,000 votes. I mean, there were just some ridiculously funny ones and creative ones. And the point of that is that there's something called mob sourcing. So we talk about crowdsourcing, which is being able to go to people to find solutions. But there's a flip side to it, a dangerous side to it, especially when you get them to vote, is the mob will speak. And so in this situation, somebody found this to be funny. They promoted it to other people. That spread around like a virus. And now all of a sudden, you've got over 100,000 people voting for Bodie McBoatface. And in the end, they didn't name the boat Bodie McBoatface. They actually found two submarines that they had Bodie McBoatface 1 and Bodie McBoatface 2. And they named the Arctic Explorer something completely different, a much more appropriate name. It's the challenge is when we bring people together, if we don't have a common purpose in what we're trying to achieve, again, we get that inefficiency, whether it's a voting or crowdsourcing, trying to solve problems. Sometimes we'll ask people to solve a problem, but we've asked a problem that's so big, broad, and abstract that we'll literally get hundreds of thousands of ideas of which none of them are going to be valuable. So it's all in the framing of the opportunity, all in the framing of the problem, where the real value comes, because that directs the activity of the organization.
Mm, yeah, I laughed just whoever, I mean, I can see that being a case study in one of Jonah Berger's newest books on that mob mentality as well. And setting that criteria up front about purpose. I was going to ask you around you've got a hardware challenge that you talk about in your book. And I used to have a podcast about facilitation, and this is where you go in and that you say it a problem and you get people to sort of ask questions to think about what the solution is. I got a sense that in your book, I think you mentioned that in some situations, people can get pretty frustrated when they're trying to navigate this problem because they just cannot see what the answer is. So as someone leading that question, like how do you sort of navigate like the frustration that's coming from the room versus like helping them make progress on that question?
Sure. So I suspect you're talking about the, it's a lateral brain teaser that I do with people. And I tell them that a person walks into a hardware store. Is that the one where somebody walks into a hardware store?
Yeah.
Okay. So person walks into a hardware store and I'll just tell it real quickly. And I tell everybody, say, look, we're going to play a game of 20 questions. So 20 questions is the game where you can ask me any number of yes, no questions. Well, technically, I guess 20. And I will give you a yes, no, or it depends answer. And you need to guess within 20 questions what it is. So the scenario is a person goes into a hardware store. They could buy six for $6, 12 for $12, or 24 for $12. And I ask them to ask me a number of yes, no questions. And almost always, like 99.99% of the time, the questions they are asking me are actually taking what they think the answer is and just reframing it as a question. So for example, if they assume that it's nails or screws, they might say, well, is this something you use to fasten something to something else? And the answer is no to that. Or if they think it has something to do, maybe they think it's a ruler or a tape measure, they might talk about, well, maybe does it have something to do with, you know, measurements? And it's like, no, it doesn't have anything to do with measurements. And what ends up happening is they keep on trying to come up with the answer and then trying to validate their answer. And that's not a very effective way to do it. But I let people do it. I let people get frustrated, partly because in that frustration, they're going to get a better and deeper experience. Because when I pull the rug from underneath them and show them how the way they are asking questions is not effective at all, it's not giving them new insights, it's not giving them new data, it's really just how we're wired as human beings, which is to validate what we are to believe to be true. So I give them a new way to think about asking questions. And then inevitably, even though it might still take a little while, someone eventually gets it. And then people really have this aha moment. Now it's painful, it's torturous, but if you really want to give somebody that insight, you have to pull the rug from out underneath them. You have to allow them to struggle a little bit with that, because if you make it too easy, they don't get the learning.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine myself in that room and I'd be asking all the same questions, you know, just the assumed stuff to validate. Really good point about we ask questions to validate our knowledge. That's really interesting. It's like that whole, we don't know what we don't know. And so it's a really important and interesting skill. You talk about complex problem formulation is actually more important than actually solving the problem. It's how do you formulate it and think about it. And that's what your book is about. So even the show is all about taking opportunities before you're even really ready, and just working and living large. So I guess for you, have you ever said yes to something where you felt like you weren't ready to do it, and things just shifted for you?
I think all the best things happened to me when I took that approach. Sometimes if I knew what it was going to take, I might not have gone down that path. I probably would have played it a lot safer. But even what we talked about earlier, you know, I had a nice job at Accenture, paid really well, took a leave of absence. In fact, at one point I told my boss, I'm quitting, never processed the paperwork. So I never actually left the company, but he somehow still managed to pay me. Don't know how they managed to make that magic happen. I was on a very long extended vacation. And then when I came up with this idea to create a practice around innovation, I remember going to one of the partners in the company. I've got this great vision. Instead of helping companies shrink, I want to help them grow. And this partner looked at me and said, that sounds fantastic. And if that's what you want to do, you should go to another company. That's not what we do here. And so I met that resistance quite a few times, but I really got it in my head and my heart and my soul that this is what I wanted to do. And I was going to find the right person and the right people. And I did. And I found a couple of people who fully supported this. The timing happened to be right. And boom, we made magic happen. We went from 0 to 20,000 people in 9 months. And, you know, it just to me was just an incredible experience to get that support. But there was also those 6 to 9 months of nothing happening and not knowing if anything was going to happen. That was a little scary, but it worked out in the end.
Yeah. I mean, did you sleep at all during those 9 months of growth? That's insane.
It was, fortunately, we had an amazing team. It was not like me, but we had a core team of people. We had about a dozen people who were working on content and organization structures. But then we started to engage larger circles of people. So we identified and handpicked 200 people who were just really great at this work already. And we just gave them our methodology for doing it. And then we put them all through a program, a 3-day program, where we helped them standardize what they were already doing around our process. Those 200 people then delivered a total of 200 training sessions to an average of 100 people in each training session to get to our 20,000 people. So the hard work was actually done by a lot of other people. And I think that's really the key with anything is if you look at yourself as the bottleneck, or if you are the bottleneck, or if you're the one who think you have to do everything, you're never going to get something big like that done. We needed to give up control. We had to believe that the dozen people who are developing the content were going to do a great job, and the 200 people who are delivering the program, they were going to do an amazing job. And that was really the key, was, you know, finding the right networks and the right people.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thanks for sharing how you actually managed to do that through networks and through trust as well, and giving people the autonomy to take it on and to run with it. I'm sure, like, you published quite a few books, you got your cards as well, you're prolific, you got your speaking, you're always out there in the public square, as Alan Weiss would say. Let's just say that, Stephen, you got a new idea today and you're like, this is amazing, I need to run with it. What would you do next?
Whoa. You sort of caught me at an interesting time in my career, because I'm reevaluating so much. I've had my own business for 20 years now. And so I am really asking myself that question, is like, what is the next thing that I'm going to go do? And you know, I think that the key is clarity drives efficiency. So everybody has a different approach. I mean, some people, their approach is to, you know, try a lot of different things. And I do that too. I do try a lot, but at the same time, sometimes I just need to sit and really get clear about what do I want to achieve? Like, what is important to me as a human being? What's going to be important to my clients and my customers? And then from there, hopefully things start to rock and roll. And I'll give you an example of how it works and how it doesn't work. So Invisible Solutions, the book that we've been primarily talking about, I wrote that 2 years ago. I locked myself in a hotel room with a pretty clear vision of what I wanted to achieve. And look, it wasn't a new concept for me. I had 10 years of material and research already developed. And in 3 days, I had the very, very rough first draft of the book. Within a couple of weeks, I had something which I thought was reasonably good. And within a matter of weeks, I was already sharing it with some clients for their feedback. Now, there was a lot of editing that it took to get it to the next level, but that happened because I had that clarity. I'm working on another book right now. This book I've been working on for, I don't know, 9 months, 12 months. It's been a long time. And I can't, even though it's content I've done for 25 years. So I have deeper understanding of this content because it's the core of my work around differentiation. But the book, I'm struggling because I don't have that clarity around the purpose of the book. Who's the book for? What's the transformation I want to see? And the people who read the book, what's the book going to do for me as a human being? Like, what do I want to achieve? And so this book is painful. It's torturous. Now, when I'm done with it, I think it's going to be probably my most powerful and most amazing book. I just have no idea what it's going to look like or when it's going to come out. And I have to be comfortable with that. So those are two different contrasting ways of working when it comes, at least to a book as an example.
Yeah, no, thanks for sharing that and being so open with that. Because I'm the same. I've got this 50-page book proposal here, and it's like just everything that I've delivered, and it's important to me. And it just is like the same thing back to purpose. It's like, what is the point of this? And I haven't landed that yet. So it's just this sort of ambiguous book that's just sitting here. And I'm hoping that I wake up one day with the answer. I don't think that's the way, though. I think I need to like give myself space, because I think my compulsion is just to start like listening and consuming information to try and solve it. But your approach, or the one approach that you've taken, is to just isolate and, you know, just get inside, get like look inside and see if you can get the answer there. Yeah.
And I think it comes back to the all important question of why. So like with the book, why am I writing the book? Mm. Now, some people write books because they make money off of books. That's a very clear why. Books are not my primary source of income, But I also don't want to view a book, like a lot of people do, as just a brochure or marketing material. There's, to me, it's more than that. And this book, to me, I'm really looking at it at a much deeper, deeper level in terms of the impact in the reader, the impact in the world, the impact in my business. And so until I get clarity on all those different forms of impact, the writing is going to be difficult. So getting that clarity of that, you know, what are we trying to achieve with this? What does it make possible? I think that's just such an important question to answer before embarking on anything.
Yeah, and I think you're right. And then the writing becomes easy because you got that clarity. It will just flow from you. But when it's just, it's really hard to write anything on that and it can stall you. We'll move to the rapid round now. So just a few questions for you. So Stephen, what is a book that has shaped the way that you think?
I'll say what just comes to mind right now, given we've been having a lot of conversation around purpose and meaning. Probably one of the books that I've read, I'd say probably the most, is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, which is, many people know the book. It's basically his writings while he was in a concentration camp during World War II. And what he found was that the people who had meaning in their life could actually find a meaning with the ones who survived. And so I love that concept of, you know, figure out what is that meaning. To me, it's more than passion. It's like, I really love the word meaning. So I'd say that's probably been an impactful book that I go back to a lot.
Yeah, that fabulous book. I've got a copy of it. Probably time to reread it as I go through navigating what I'm doing next as well. Hey, what's a favorite app or tool that you recommend or that you love so much that you use it all the time?
Well, the one that I use all the time now is Zoho, which is basically a CRM, but it's more than a CRM. I mean, I run all of my accounting on it. I run all my invoices, my contracts, all of my email campaigns. I mean, basically it's everything in there. Now, that's not really an app. It's more like 50 different apps within Zoho. For the traveler, one which a lot of people know about, but the one that I like is TripIt Pro, which is just now that we're starting to get back onto planes, you know, I can't imagine not having TripIt Pro in my back pocket or in my phone.
Yeah, TripIt's great. And it sort of will notify you when a flight's delayed before the airline even notifies you. And you've been to Australia, didn't you say? You've been scuba diving up north in North Queensland?
Yes. Port Douglas, one of my favorite places. I went diving there several times. So I always call that my spiritual home because it was just scuba diving for the first time was just a very spiritual experience. And I love it there.
That's amazing. Yeah, I did my scuba diving ticket in Thailand, but which is ridiculous because we got the beauty up north. Hey, what's the song that gets you fired up?
Song that gets me fired up. There's a bunch, but one, it's an oldie, but Chicago's Make Me Smile, which is the first part of a much longer ballad that they have. But I don't know, that one just, the drums and the beats and I don't know. There's so many songs that get me going.
Yeah, you don't have to justify it. You don't have to rationalize your favorite song and a favorite quote.
I'll give you one that was never actually said, but I still like it. Einstein is quoted as saying, he never said it, but I like it anyway. He said, if I had an hour to save the world, I'd spend 59 minutes defining the problem, 1 minute finding solutions. So I like that. Really what he said was something much more complicated and convoluted, but it comes down to the formulation of the problem is more important than the actual solving of the problem. So that's one which I always like. And then there's Will Rogers who said, and I'll get it wrong, but something to the effect of, it's not what you know that gets you into trouble. It's what you don't know that ain't so. And I think that's always a good thing is we have blind spots. We have beliefs that aren't true. And if we don't overcome those blind spots and assumptions, we're going to be going in the wrong direction.
Oh, that's so good. It kind of reminds me, I was in a group coaching program the other day and a guy was like challenging me on something and I was just resisting it and like, you know, arguing back. And then a couple of days later, I thought, you know, he's right. So anytime you sort of encounter that resistance or something that is challenging you, it's good to really sort of think about and contemplate from that perspective. Steve, it's been so good to chat to you and also to share some of the pragmatic approaches that you have for defining problems and asking better questions. If our listeners would like to connect with you, where should we send them?
Best place is my website, steveshapiro.com. And by the way, if you go to the bottom of the page, there is actually an article that I just released on how we created that 20,000 person practice in 9 months. It's like a 10-page article. So you can get that at the bottom of the page.
Cool. Yeah, because we didn't get the whole story. So yeah, we'll definitely share that link in the show notes for this one. Thank Excellent. You so much for being here today.
It was awesome. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
You're the best. Thank you so much for tuning in to Work and Live Large. I really appreciate you. If you know someone in your network and you think, oh my gosh, they've got so much potential, like I want them to live and work larger, send them this episode. I think they might appreciate it. I also appreciate hearing from you, your feedback, your thoughts, your questions, anything. You can shoot me an email, hello@leannehughes.com, or find me on LinkedIn, just search for Leanne Hughes. Stay up to date with all the episodes by heading on over to leannehughes.com/subscribe, and all the best with your week as you go around living it up.